listener-supported radio for you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
So I never step up with these gonna say something that's just pleasing, right? So what I'm gonna talk about, and what's very, very important in this moment, is do not let these switch the narrative. Do not let these motherfuckers switch the narrative. Whether you bust windows, whether you come and sit down, it's repression that created the conditions. It's repression that created the conditions. When you stand on a people's neck, none of us can dictate how the fuck that goes. Right? So do not let these motherfuckers switch the narrative. Violent or non-violent, they coming down on our ass. Violent or non-violent, they coming down on our ass. They killed Dr. King and Malcolm. So do not let these motherfuckers twist the narrative. It's a time coming soon of where they're going to try to amp up and ramp up the repression. And the thing that they will count on is that we fight and argue over tactics. We better get smart than a We better learn how to use our motherfucking inside voice when we deal with this.
That's right.
We better learn to talk with our motherfucking inside voice when it comes to strategies and tactics. We got the same goddamn enemy. They don't give a fuck whether you break a window or whether you sit down. All they care about is if your tactics are effectively. That's all they care about. You can be peaceful to the mother. You can be flowers and daisies all goddamn day. They will gun your ass down in these streets if you with they. But you can also break a mother window and not be effective. So listen, Be clear on what your strategy is impacting. Whether you violent, non-violent, we ain't telling nobody what the fuck to do. Be clear about that. Because there's been a lot of bull circulating online. And I speak plainly. I ain't scared of them. That's the police or motherfucker in these streets that differ with my tactics. So let me tell you something. Do not let these motherfuckers divide us. We ain't gonna always see eye to eye. But God damn it, we need to learn how to have family conversations. We ain't gonna always see eye to eye, but we better grow the and learn how to have grown folks conversations. And when we walk out in this motherfucker, we better be on one page. Because you can bet your ass while we arguing, them motherfucking snipers and whatever else they got gonna cut our ass down in the middle of the argument. So, one, I want you to walk away with some. So, one, learn how to speak with your goddamn inside voice. Learn how to talk to each other. Learn how to work through the differences. Be clear that in struggle is historically the fact that people don't always see eye to eye. But what is also historically true is there's a waiting to take advantage of those differences if we don't know how to process forward. So, once again, do not let these motherfuckers divide us. Say it with me. Do not let these motherfuckers divide us.
I'ma still sing my song. I'ma still shout my life. Can't stop me. You can't stop me, no. I'ma still sing my song. I'ma still shine my light. You can't stop me.
They said we locked down, okay, I'm going in my bag. Gonna be a beast, sharpening the skills, working on the craft. Transported the lab to the living room, sheltered in place. I'll be compelled to create, might catch me singing old Tony, Tony, Tony. Off the balcony, like in Italy, where my neighbors going viral. Mode survival, got the vital, stock the cupboards. Grocery store was on some other, so alarming. Filling shopping carts and fighting over shaman. I'm looking for them vitamins, I'm not a scientist. But if we would've listened to Larry Brilliant, we wouldn't be in this predicament. No more hugs or handshakes. Shakes of fists, we bumping elbows, coughing in public, damn near criminals, side eyes and smirks. How we gonna pay rent? Can't work. All my musician homies out here, pockets is hurt. They can bail out Wall Street with over 1 trillion. I'm trying to figure out how to stretch that 1200. Congress need to put a stop to all the rent and mortgage. Put our heads together, we can manifest abundance. Come on.
I'ma still sing my song.
Gin with the prayers every morning. Gotta check in with the spirit, so important. Ride the cold with the quarantine. Open mic live streams. Good to see my people still striving. D-Nice broke Instagram with the livest party ever on the net. On the really been event. Was you there when Chris Rochelle had him at Liege? Let's support our people no matter prestige. Hard times when you got mouths to feed and the gigs canceled. Time to get innovative. We can't sit idle. Every night I go IG live on the piano and it's helpful. Made a little something on the Venmo. Told my daughter stay productive. Now she conducting workouts on Zoom, a walking bucket. I'm about to start online lessons, private instruction. In the face of adversity, seize the moment. Maybe this a time of reflection, connection to self and family and health and God and heart and soul and dreams. Or sit still and just be whatever help you feel free. Come on.
I'ma still sing my song. I gotta shine my. Thank you.
is where we give thanks. We show up always first with gratitude, for we know who and whose we are. We are so grateful. As we take this time to settle in, to be present, to allow the world around us to slow down, we are so grateful. We are grateful that we can remember who and whose we are, what our responsibility is in this life, what agreements we made as divine energy before we chose to be in these human forms. We are grounded. We are confident. We know what is ours to do. As we allow the world to slow down around us, we can hear clearly the divine melody that is only for us to hear. We came so that we may inspire each other, that we may love one another. Divine essence acting as me, I give thanks. I give thanks for all the moments before this now perfect queendom of heaven, this moment. I give thanks for the moments where I forgot that I was God, for I would never be able to be in this space right now. But I know my purpose. I know my work in this world. And I am willing, I am able.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. I am your host, Anita Johnson. We were able to have a conversation with Dr. De La Torre, an immigrant advocate. We spoke with him in April. So some of today's conversation might seem a little dated. I just want to say this is before the height of the pandemic, as well as all the uprisings that we're experiencing now in relationship to Black Lives Matter happening in the nation. So again, this conversation took place in April. Stay tuned. As COVID-19 cases spread through immigration and customs enforcement detention centers across the U.S., immigrants locked inside are frantic that they could get sick and die. Experts warn that the pandemic could drastically magnify the harms caused by failures in ICE medical care. The virus's spread has provoked increasingly urgent calls for ICE to release people from detention centers in order to prevent massive outbreaks among detainees. Joining us now by phone to discuss this issue is Dr. De La Torre, an immigration advocate. Miguel, thank you so much for joining us today here on the program. And just briefly, some information for the listeners. On the CDC website, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, they provide some common sense guidelines for prisons and detention centers to curb the spread of COVID-19. These facilities, the CDC says, should avoid cohorting people who have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, that is, quarantining them together. Nationwide, ICE says about 425 detainees have tested positive for the coronavirus as of Tuesday, but immigrant advocates fear that the virus is much more widespread than what's being reported by ICE. ICE has only tested only about a fraction of those in custody. As of Tuesday, ICE said that it had tested only 705 detainees out of the more than 31,000 in detention and had released only 700 people from detention and is considering releasing others, potentially vulnerable populations. Miguel, first question. What's your thoughts to ICE's tortoise-like response to the outbreak, the lack of urgency overall that we're seeing?
Well, my response, quite frankly, is quite complex because it highlights so many different troubling and problematic things with that response. First of all, it ignores that right now in the detention center there is a ticking time bomb. As we know, this virus manifests itself sometimes weeks later. And when it does, we don't have the necessary equipment to take care of all those who are going to be ill. So I think it's gross, inhuman, and I would even say human rights violation of the way these individuals are being treated. The second, I think, major concern is what it means to be a brown body in the United States. We're talking about individuals who are seeking asylum. We're talking about individuals who are not criminals, but rather are looking for an opportunity to advance themselves and their family. And yet we're treating them worse than murderers and thieves, and as though they are not, they have no value whatsoever. Every human being has value, regardless. But these are individuals like you and myself who are just on the different side of the border, and to basically place them in a situation where their lives could come to an end, again, is inhuman and a violation of basic human rights. And finally, when they say that the numbers that they've tested and the people who have the virus, I agree, those numbers are under representative. And I say that because ICE has a habit of doing this. When it reports how many people die crossing the desert, we know those numbers are largely underrepresentative. They're undercounted. It's as if brown bodies aren't even worth counting. So we are in the midst of probably the greatest human rights violation occurring in this country at this time, and yet very few people are talking about this. So I'm very conflicted by the silence of the carnage that's going to occur in these detention camps.
We've spoken before on the program, and we've looked at this particular issue and the lack of coverage that is received. And I feel like with the outbreak, looking at COVID-19, it's really magnified the existing problems with these detention centers. As we all know, that it was already a broken system that provided detainees with inadequate care, and past deaths in custody highlight the dire risk that immigrants, detainees face during the COVID-19 outbreak. Miguel, as an immigration advocate, what have you heard regarding the potential health risk to this already vulnerable and targeted population while incarcerated?
The individuals that I know who are at the border, who are working hands-on with these immigrant groups, are all saying the same thing. There's a ticking time bomb, that that this is going to escalate as the number of individuals become ill and begin to die. But I think when we say that the system is broken, I think what your hearers really need to understand is that one of the reasons it's broken is because the detention centers are for-profit corporations. This is something new in this country's history, in where we try to make a profit off of the incarceration of individuals. And when you're trying to make a profit, basic necessities like medical care, like soap, become luxuries because they eat into the bottom line, into the profit margins. So part of the reason the structure is so broken is because these detention centers are out for profit, not out for preserving human dignity.
Going back to the thought of the way in which the system, we've said, is broken, it's intentionally broken. It works in the best interest of capitalists who are looking to make a buck and profit off of human misery. I want to, for a minute, look at the retaliatory actions that have been happening within these detention centers based on folks wanting to get the word out to the public on what's actually happening, especially right now as we're all facing COVID-19. I know on April 21st, there were 5 women at the Irwin County Detention Center in rural Georgia were segregated after they used a video teleconferencing app available to all detainees in many ICE facilities to describe overcrowding, deficient sanitation, and other conditions at Irwin that made them feel terrified about contracting COVID-19. Then also in South Louisiana, ICE Processing Center, for instance, women who made a video had their access to phone calls and television temporarily cut off and video visitation hours permanently reduced. In both cases, you know, we're hearing this throughout the United States, but men and women who are protesting in this way, wanting to get the word out so people can actually see and hear what's going on, are being further traumatized and tortured and retaliated against simply for speaking out regarding their existing conditions within these facilities. Maybe you can speak directly to that.
Of course, of course. And the reason I think why you see this type of abuse is because as far as these detention centers are concerned, these individuals have no rights whatsoever. They're not U.S. citizens, therefore they do not exist as far as having rights are concerned. And and as abusive as the system can be towards them, they have no recourse by which to hold the government and hold these private corporations accountable for their actions. Because at the end of the day, they'll be deported back to the countries that of which which are their origins, and because they're deported back, they will no longer have any access by which to get the word out as to what they suffered. And this has been going on before COVID-19,
right,
with women who have been sexually abused, children who have been sexually abused, who are sent back, and once they're back, there's nothing that could be done because they don't have access to what most individuals who are in prison systems, who are U.S. Citizens, have access to. The problem is that because we have dehumanized these undocumented immigrants, we can then do inhuman things to them.
Right.
And this is really a moral issue of who we are as a people and as a nation.
I think the thing, too, for me, when I watched the video and researched for this particular conversation today, is the irony of ICE, the hypocrisy of ICE, should I say. Saying that they're doing the best that they can, they're trying to provide safe conditions, but yet they're afraid to allow this information to get out. And in response, they punish folks who, as you mentioned at the top of the conversation, are being detained for wanting a better life. Many of them have no criminal records, and their only violation is based on immigration status, right? So, you know, maybe you can speak to what ICE is truly trying to attempting to hide in this particular time of mass crackdown and retaliatory actions against detainees.
Absolutely, and we have to remember that ICE is responsible for rounding up the undocumented immigrants and placing them into these for-profit prison systems, specifically the two major ones. What we have to really understand is that these two detention center companies, which were practically going bankrupt back in the 80s and 90s, got a new lease in life when we decided as a nation that the best way to deter the immigrants is to force them to serve some time in prison. So the U.S. government signed contracts with these for-profit corporations guaranteeing a certain amount of beds that need to be occupied. So rather, if those beds are occupied or not occupied, I still have to pay them for those beds. So the goal is to make sure that the beds are occupied to get the full return on their investment. Now, once these corporations started really turning major profits, they began to hire lobbyists to write the legislations to ensure that the system is an operation that they constantly have a flow of these immigrants going in. So in a way, the whole structure, if you ask what's the purpose of this, the purpose is to make sure that these for-profit corporations have enough inmates to turn a profit to help pay to pay stakeholders and stockholders a good return on their investment. Because if we were to fix this immigration crisis, if we were to fix this problem, these corporations will go bankrupt. And if they go bankrupt, a lot of individuals who have retirement funds, whose stocks are tied into these corporations will lose value in their retirement fund for the future. So in a way, what we've created is a system that really can no longer fail, because if it does, a lot of average people who have retirement funds are going to get hurt, and more importantly, these corporations will go bankrupt. So it has nothing to do now with detaining immigrants or with deterrence. It has to do with making profit. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes this so frustrating.
And again, many of the people being detained have no criminal record. They're being held on a civil immigration violation. We've seen that judges have found that their detention during a pandemic to be excessive punishment and a new form of torture. As they're releasing only, say, 700 or 705 individuals out of the almost 31,000 people that are in these detention centers, what we're realizing as they're opting with some to put them on electric monitors, electric ankle monitors, to make sure that they are able to show up in court at later dates. To me, what that says is that these folks don't need to be detained to begin with. And it speaks to your point around the profit, and the profit margin is so great, you know, that this is the way in which this country is operating at the expense of innocent people.
Oh, absolutely. People of color in this country have always been expendable for the purpose of making profit for the dominant culture. This is part of our history. It has always been the case. It continues to be the case. The only difference is that we mask that reality so much better today than we may have done 100 or 200 years ago.
Speak more to that. What do you mean by, I understand what mask mean, but you know, you would think that in the age of technology and our ability to see what's going on, that it would be more obvious than, say, in the 1800s. Maybe if you can speak directly to that.
Of course. I mean, you would think that is the case, but when you have demagogues who are basically using fear of the immigrant as a way of garnering votes and of getting reelected, what's actually happening becomes masked or it's hidden, it's concealed, and in its place just becomes this fear and terror of the stranger who is coming, before COVID-19, we looked at these brown caravans of immigrants coming to our borders, bringing diseases. And yet the irony of it all is that this country has more cases of COVID-19 than any other country in the world.
Right.
And it is we who are exporting this disease to these countries south of our borders, as we return these immigrants who have been in our detention center, who have been exposed to our U.S. virus.
I wanted to get you to maybe talk a bit about this, because I found it really hypocritical, and it was senseless. In the age of COVID-19, dealing with this pandemic, we've been hearing a lot of reports and public service announcements about the importance of practicing social distancing. But we all know that cannot exist within these facilities of torture, be it, you know, prisons, jails, and detention centers. Help folks understand the inability to social distance in these immigration detention centers, and why are we missing that larger conversation? You know, I'm watching these PSAs, they're talking about stay home and this and that, and the conversation around people that are incarcerated or immigrant detainees, that is being missed and overlooked intentionally. Maybe if you can, I know you have something to say about that.
Of course. Well, I mean, it's not just a detention center, and I will give an example in a few seconds, but just overall, as you well know, the vast majority of those individuals who are being diagnosed and are dying of COVID-19 are Latinx and African Americans. And one of the reasons is not because they're genetically somehow inferior, but rather they are the poorest of society, disproportionately poorer than the dominant culture, and therefore are forced to work in conditions where they have a greater exposure to the virus. Now, This is just in society, and we're barely even talking about that.
Right.
So why should we even be concerned that in Donillos, Texas, where you have a camp for children, you put over 100 of them in one room, crowded in a fenced area, where when the virus hits that place, it is going to be a human tragedy. That's not even in the consciousness of this country, when we're not even looking at those within our own neighborhood who are disproportionately being impacted by it. So it's unconscionable.
Excellent point. You know, in preparation for today's conversation, I was reading and, you know, looking for particular questions, and then I also wanted to have something that was more of a positive, to really end on a positive note. But, you know, it was the one silver lining that I could find is that with the pandemic, right, it seems to be that there's this ramping of activism in the face of the prison industrial complex during this particular pandemic. In what ways have you noticed or seen organized efforts unfold during this particular COVID-19 pandemic? Do you see this as a way of being able to effectively get their voices and have this issue be more magnified or be provided more attention, because everybody's focused on what's happening with COVID-19, and then also not only within the detention centers, but also in looking at, you know, letting people go who are incarcerated in prisons and jails if they don't need to be there, if they're waiting bail hearings and stuff like that. There's been an urgency to kind of get local state officials to move more quickly. So my question to you now that I've said all that is, do you see there being a silver lining? In what ways have you seen or noticed organized efforts unfold during this COVID-19 pandemic, for better or for worse?
Okay. So I think I like to answer that in two different ways, during the pandemic and a post-pandemic. So during the pandemic, unfortunately, because of social distance, because of lockdown, because we're all pretty much huddled in our individual homes, it's very difficult to do social activism except through internet and through Facebook or social media. And all that's nice, but it doesn't really get to the voices of the individuals who are mostly affected. And when those voices do come out, like you mentioned in Georgia, they are drowned by all the other oxygen that's being taken up from the room by all the other issues that are going on. Unfortunately, you'll see more reports about, can you get COVID-19 from your pet dog, than you will hear anything about the immigrants in Georgia. So at the moment right now, I do see it as a standstill. I do see that not much is being done that I could notice, because a lot of us can't get out into the streets. Saying that, obviously, we will one day leave our homes. We will one day be able to get back to being more active. What this COVID-19 has, I hope, taught this country is not just that our prison system is broken, not that just immigration is broken, but healthcare is broken. The student loan complex system is broken. Pretty much everything that relies on some kind of a social net is broken. I mean, the undoing of the social net since the 1980s till now has made this country tremendously vulnerable to anything like this virus. I mean, just think about it. This is the first time the United States in the modern era has not been a leader in dealing with a global crisis. That means the United States isn't even, leading the world as its propaganda used to say it did. And I say this because, you know, this is an interesting moment that we have in our history. Usually after pandemics like this, whether it be in 1347 or 1665, or the Spanish flu of 1918, society radically changed, and a lot of legislation began to be passed that be, you know, they're trying to make our social contract more humane. I would hope that we will follow in that tradition and maybe rethink how we do immigration, rethink how we do prison, rethink how we do student loans or how we do healthcare. But the danger is that we there's such a partisan, this country is so divided by partisan politics that we may find ourselves digging deeper into resistance of putting the needs of individuals first and instead putting the needs of corporations first. And I say that as a warning after the debacle of this of the Small Business Administration giving out loans, ending up giving out the loans to major corporations who really didn't need it, but not to the, who it was intended to.
Right. I'm hoping that the latter isn't the case. I feel like there's been a great deal of energy around resisting capitalism as we know it, especially whether people are, you know, these bipartisan politics. The reality is that whether you're, you know, black, white, you know, brown, you know, straight, gay, young, old, you know, male or female, the reality is when we think about the healthcare system, it's impacting everyone across the board in the exact same
Absolutely.
Way.
And,
go ahead.
And you're right. It doesn't matter anymore if you're a middle class white cisgender male. You will die in the emergency room just like people of color have always been dying in the emergency room for lack of proper care. So maybe this could be a wake-up call. I'm just always a little hesitant in being that hopeful. But we have an opportunity at this moment. And people like the listeners to your program, scholars like myself, activists in the streets really need to really push now, once we could get back into the streets, to demand changes so we can move towards a more just society.
Look, I understand your reasons for not being extremely optimistic. And just to give a simple example of something that I said last week was, you know, after Trump suggested that people ingest disinfectant cleaner to combat COVID-19.
I'm sorry, I can't keep a straight
right?
Can't keep a straight face.
Right. But so in that moment, I was like, that should be the nail in the coffin. That should be it for him. He should just pack up and call it a day. He still is able to been able to respin that, and there has not been a larger, greater outcry when you think this is the person who is quote unquote leading this country. That this would be something that will be acceptable, and that there would not be an immediate demand that, you know, he's able to say it's fake news, or he blames the journalists for questioning his inability to lead or his lack of knowledge around these issues that are is impacting the entire country. And then there's cases of people that have actually drank bleach and gotten sick. So I don't know. I can see why you're not too optimistic. Maybe that's just me, but I can understand your lack of optimism, you know.
Yeah, no, and again, I hope I'm totally wrong. I hope that we do rise up and take advantage of this moment and demand the human rights and the dignity that every individual in this country should have, and not just this country, but throughout the world. But it takes work, and it'll take people to actually go out and vote, to actually organize, to actually make demands. You know, I don't know. Maybe as more people lose jobs, as more people, as the economic and financial ruins impact so many more individuals, people may come to a point that they have nothing else to lose. They might as well demand change.
It's a very sad day in our history's country, and we've had plenty of sad and ugly days. This is definitely, you know, but just to see where we're at this point. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Miguel De La Torre, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today here on Hard Knock.
Always a pleasure.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And joining us on the phone line are two brothers who always are doing good things in the community, always making a lot of noise, and continuing their plight to correct some inadequacies that are existing, in particular what's going on in Puerto Rico. They've been working on a documentary in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, and y'all are getting ready to turn a corner and do big things. So we have the Fantuzzi brothers on, Eli and Khalil. Welcome to the show. And the first question we ask everybody is, how are you all doing in the pandemic? But I really want to find out how you all are doing, because you have some context to compare it with. You understood what went on when safety nets were removed, the government was upended, and people found themselves in dire straits. In Maria is very similar to what people were experiencing in New Orleans. So how are you all seeing this pandemic, and, you know, with what you understood took place in places like Puerto Rico? So go ahead.
Wow, thank you, Davey, and what an honor to be back on Hard Knock with the fam. So it's been a difficult time, I think, for everybody during this pandemic, but as you said, we learned so much after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. When the government didn't show up, we see that the people hurt first and the worst are the most vulnerable in society. And the film that we're working on right now is called We Still Here, and it's about a group of youth in the mountains of Comerio, Puerto Rico, in the middle of the island, who come together, who don't wait for the government or local officials to come and save them. They save themselves. They start organizing themselves. They start rebuilding, clearing out people's homes, putting up tarps, and then rebuilding homes. And that's what a just recovery looks like for us. It's when the vision of the community gets the resources and they can make their dreams come true. It's not dropping water bottles off of helicopters. It's not dumping resources in a community and having them fight over the little resources that exist. It has to involve the community. The vision has to come from the community, and us as allies could help empower them and give them resources so those dreams come true.
You talked about people coming together. Was there something about what was going on in Puerto Rico that allowed that to happen that we may not see happening as readily or as often here in the States? Were there conditions that existed? Was it a cultural thing, so to speak? People just raised a certain way. Have we lost our way in terms of being able to survive without, you know, without the government, so to speak?
I think there is a cultural aspect to it. When we're talking about the mountains of Puerto Rico, the Jibaro culture, the know your neighbor, come inside, have some cafecito, you're welcome to have dinner, that you look out for one another more. But I see it happening right here in East Oakland. I see homies, I see people, organizations that see themselves in their community and are not going to let others suffer and do everything they can to step up and help people during this time. So I see a reflection of that happening in the Bay, definitely.
Khalil, how are you seeing things in this pandemic?
Well, first of all, it's
first of all, you got serious gray beard, so you've been really doing the pandemic. You haven't had a chance to really shave it off or anything, huh?
I'm taking this quarantine seriously. You know, I'm in Brooklyn, New York. So.
Oh wow! I didn't realize. So you're in the middle of all this. Oh wow!
I'm in the middle. I'm in Bed-Stuy, and I'm taking it seriously. So I think that what's happening in New York is definitely seeing communities that are vulnerable getting affected. The Latino and African American communities have been hit really, really hard. And I think that it's hard because people want to come together and people want to support each other. But there's no history, there's no book to follow, there's no script to follow. So I think people are really struggling with how to go about that.
Are there lessons that we should be gleaning from people in New York, in Bed-Stuy, where you're at? Or is there something that we should know, some missteps that have taken place that we should avoid?
I mean, I think what it comes down to is people just being really cautious of how they carry themselves. And I think that what has happened in New York is at first there was kind of this lax kind of people still riding the subways and people still in each other's space that created the peak that we saw. I think now, even if you're walking in the hood or wherever you're going, you see people wearing masks now and people being more conscientious of how they're coming across each other and how they're carrying themselves in this time.
Let me ask you both, Eli and Khalil, the real impact of any sort of calamity, whether we're talking about Katrina, whether we're talking about Hurricane Maria, and I would argue even if we're talking about the COVID-19 virus, is that the real damage comes in the aftermath, in what Naomi Klein has deemed disaster capitalism. How are you seeing this sort of thing, especially with your film, Eli, in terms of how the government and people in positions of power will take advantage of a catastrophe to further exploit and disenfranchise people?
Definitely, and we see it time and time again. We saw in New Orleans after Katrina when, you know, they closed all the school systems, privatized them, and didn't let the people back in and changed the city. We saw the same happen in Puerto Rico where there were huge land grabs. But don't forget, I'll put the sprinkle of hope on there. The people were fed up with the government. And I think around the world, they were looking at Puerto Rico during this time. And when those chats came out where he, you know, just let the world know how corrupt they were and their thoughts, they said that enough is enough. And we took to the streets and we ousted him straight up. We took him out of government, made him resign and said, Ricky, renuncia, you're out of here. And so hopefully that's an example that could happen around the world. Governments that didn't do their job during this time period, the people always have the power, and we need to take to the streets and let them know we're not having it.
But can we take to the streets now in the pandemic?
I don't think it's a good time to do that. I think we could be activists and uphold people's stories and let our officials know right here in the house, writing emails, getting on the phone, making phone calls. But the time will come where we need to take to the streets. I know it's not the best time, but in like Brazil and other countries in Latin America, they couldn't wait. There are no laws of social distancing. So they're taking to the streets right now. There are protests happening right now. In Puerto Rico, there are very unique ways that they're doing it. Even the like firefighters and EMT workers got in their cars and went to Old San Juan, to the Fortaleza, and protested that way. So you could do it from your cars. We got to be unique, strategic, and innovative in these times, and I believe we can do that.
Let's talk about where you're at with this documentary. I said you turned a corner. There are lessons to be learned. When I say turn the corner, exactly where are you? What do you want people to do? And will you include this pandemic situation with respect to it?
We've been shooting in Puerto Rico like weeks after the hurricane. And we really have been able to tell a story in a unique way, which is really, you know, groundbreaking. And it's hearing the voices and the experiences of the community that are experiencing what's happening first. Right. And we actually follow the youth as they mobilize and they organize and they become more powerful. They actually came to FEMA headquarters in Washington, D.C. and marched in the halls of Congress. So we follow them to that really historical kind of moment. Mm. And so we are now in the process of editing, making sure that we get the storyline and make sure that we tell a story that's authentic, that's true, and that's inspirational.
What do you want our listeners to do at this point? How can we further help, or what do you want us to look out for?
So you could go check out on Indiegogo, We Still Here documentary, We Still Here, Aquí Estamos. We just did a successful crowdfunding campaign asking our community to support us as filmmakers during this time. And but if we can raise some more money, it's about getting the film out. So I think we have enough right now to finish the film, but it's always difficult for distribution and promotion. So if people donate, you can get a Fist Up TV t-shirt, you know, and you also get really cool perks if you contribute. And yeah, I think that way you'll get the updates. You'll be part of the crew that helped birth this film into the world. And it's such a necessary film at this time.
Eli, how many films have you done so far? This ain't your first rodeo. So just, I want to say that because, you know, I don't want people to think that you're a rookie at this, but you've been doing this for a minute in addition to the Fist Up Film Festival.
Yes. Me and Khalil's co-produced each one of those films. And I think it's about our fifth. We did Inventos Hip Hop Cubano. That was kind of our first one out the gates. We did Homegrown Hip Life in Ghana, which was Ghana, West Africa. We've done Revolucion Sin Muertos in Colombia. We've done Baco Sol in Cuba that we've been touring right now and that we got caught short. Actually, that's why I'm in California. I came out here for two film festivals and they got canceled and I didn't feel like flying. I wanted to be safe. So I'm actually here in California. But as soon as things open up, I'll be back in Puerto Rico.
Okay. And, you know, again, give out the website and everything, Khalil, where people can go to.
Yeah, you can go to www.fistup.tv.
Okay.
And in the month of June is actually going to be the 11th annual Fist Up Film Festival. And we're taking it digitally, and therefore you don't have to get stuck by geographic location. Anybody in the world can participate. And we really have turned the idea of a film festival upside down. So there are no admission fees for the filmmakers to submit their projects. And every film that we show is completely free and it's meant to have discussion and dialogue. So we're going to be screening the films and then doing question and answer periods afterwards with the filmmakers.
And that's going to be good. It's you know, because people can now tap in from all over and really have an engaged conversation. So Khalil, Eli, thank you very much for joining us on Hard Knock Radio. I know you have to bounce out, Eli, so I'm gonna let you get to your next appointment. We're gonna take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. Khalil, you stay safe in New York, man. You know, that's the belly of the beast and there's so much going on. So we'll have to check in with you separate from this just to find out what's going on as things continue to unfold. So we're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
What does it mean to be sheltered in place if the place you sheltered in don't feel safe? And how do we become so qualified to judge and chastise and lose the ability to empathize with those who don't feel safe inside for whatever reason? You know, you sometimes ain't got the luxury of feeling safe at home when you ain't got a safe space to call your own. No privacy, no courtesy, no bed, nor peace of mind. You're grateful for a roof over your head, but that's not where everybody spends their time. So by this time, you're already mastered trying to stay out the way. And you already overheard chatter about not overextending your stay. And trying to find resources hard without a computer or Wi-Fi. Plus, employment opportunities are scarce and local businesses are boarded up. So you're being honest with yourself, asking like, why try? And it's not that everybody who's outside right now is even trying to be selfish. You know, some don't even want to be outside. They're just trying to avoid the insult of being displaced inside. You see, there's a lot of uncomfortable going on. And despite what you see on your timeline, not everybody's dancing to the same song. You know, some are dancing to the tune of loneliness and some ain't dancing at all. Some have their phones glued to their face and some ain't got no phones at all. No homes at all. No clocks on the wall. No time at all. No TikTok. No selfies. No hashtags. No memes. No statuses with complaints about how much food they overate. You know, some are still trying to find a meal and some are still trying to find their meal. I saw a broken car glass on my run around the block today. I must got a lot running through my mind today. Probably an indicator that I need to be still and pray, but the fact is we are all in this together, and the ones who judge and lead without love must not know no better. The world's lungs are under attack, and we're wasting precious breath on judgment, conspiracy theories about the government. Remember, we don't all have the same privilege when it comes on to access to information, and we're not all watching the same station. And after 10 years as an administrator in special education, I can tell you we all learn different. Matter of fact, it's time for a deep breath. It's time for a reset. Creatives, be gentle with yourselves. It's okay to take a break. Your value as a person is not defined by the art you create. Some of us are called to be light, and all of us are called to be salt. Preserve your well-being. Let love and kindness be your currency. Let Christ's compassion lead the way. And despite what economists say, empathy is the new wave. And it's the same as the old one too. It's all cyclical. And if you believe that money makes the world go round, then yeah, this standstill can be scary. But there are those of us who learn to speak without talking and move without walking. This is a journey to the inside. No more sweeping it under the rug. That rug is filled. And yes, the pain is present. Thank you.
tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
There is power in a union. Now I long for the
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor.